Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, January 19th, 2026. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, wishing you a happy Martin Luther King Day Jr. holiday. The featured photo on today's cover page is of Governor Hobbs walking down an aisle. The caption reads, "Governor Katie Hobbs takes the floor to deliver her fourth State of the State speech in Phoenix on January 12th. Hobbs recently vetoed a tax plan from GOP lawmakers that she said was a wish list of every tax proposal they've ever introduced that blows a huge hole in our budget. The lead article is titled, "Hobbs Swiftly Vetoes GOP Tax Cut Package. Republicans Say Governor Causing Filing Headaches," by Ray Stern, Helen Rummel, and Stacey Bartschinger. Governor Katie Hobbs is again calling on lawmakers to establish an income cap on families to receive private school vouchers, a long-shot request that is among her policy goals for her fourth year in office. Hobbs' aides detailed the governor's plans to rein in the Empowerment Scholarship Accounts program, a longtime target for Democrats, on January 16th as part of her budget rollout. Hobbs' team proposed a spending plan for the state fiscal year that begins July 1 that includes her vision for complying with federal tax changes signed into law by President Donald Trump last year. Hours earlier, Hobbs swiftly vetoed a dueling Republican-backed tax plan, guaranteeing the battle at the state capitol over how much money Arizonans pay their tax bills for last year will continue brewing. Hobbs, a Democrat, said GOP lawmakers sent her a wish list of every tax proposal they've ever introduced that blows a huge hole in our budget. The governor's office proposed a $17.7 billion budget that includes funding for her priorities, announced January 12th in her State of the State speech. Those include initiatives to help lower-income Arizonans pay electricity bills and expand affordable housing. More details about her plans for education funding and vouchers, and a proposal to raise the fee paid by some sports betting license holders. "There isn't fluff, there isn't waste or bloat," Hobbs said of her budget. "Just the state of Arizona tackling issues that the people of our state expect us to deliver on." Hobbs' new income cap on ESA vouchers. For the fourth year in a row, Hobbs is calling for reform within the state's Universal Empowerment Scholarship Account program. Under the governor's proposed budget, households making more than $250,000 per year would no longer be eligible for ESA funding. That would impact 11,000 students, according to the governor's office, which is just over 10% of the roughly 100,000 students currently using ESA vouchers. In total, the cap would bring $89.3 million in savings to the state budget. The proposal will face a strenuous battle against the Republican-held legislature, who have broadened school choice in Arizona considerably since the voucher program was expanded in 2022. Hobbs also wants to stop families from carrying over their funding from ESA vouchers from one year to the next, pointing to extraneous spending and hoarding. "There's a significant amount of money sitting in private bank accounts that we really don't know what's being used for," Hobbs spokesperson Christian Slater said. Slater said the Arizona Department of Education has roughly $2.9 million in an administrative fund which could be used to hire new staff for auditing the purchases people make with ESA funds. Officials with the governor's office argue Trump has shown support for high threshold income caps on some school choice policies. However, Arizona Republicans have continued to resist increasing restrictions on school choice. Arizona GOP Chair Gina Swoboda was called on to resign by multiple Republicans for saying more guardrails need to be put in place in the statewide system after reports showed some parents use vouchers to pay for jewelry, lingerie, and other luxury items. The governor's budget pitch. Hobbs' budget assumes a strong but fragile economic outlook, and that several hypotheticals come to fruition. Her budget debut begins a months-long process at the Capitol, where a negotiated plan must win majority support in the legislature and her signature to fund state programs by a June 30th deadline. Hobbs' plan counts on a $760 million windfall from the Big Beautiful Bill to reimburse border-related costs though the federal government has not created a formal application process to pursue those dollars. It also assumes renewal of Proposition 123, an expanded funding measure that takes additional money from the state land trust to fund K-12 education. Hobbs has been unable to find common ground with the Republican majority on a Proposition 123 extension in years past, however, and it would need to be approved by voters before becoming a reality. Her latest plans include devoting a slice of money from the state land trust to issue $1.5 billion in bonds over 3 years to pay for school facilities improvements. Some of Arizona's licensed sports betting facilities would also pay more under Hobbs' plan. Hobbs wants to create a tiered structure where operators who tally more than $75 million in monthly revenue pay a 45% fee to the state. Operators who make less than $75 million a month would stay at the current rate for all operators, which is 10% of their gross wagering revenue. Put into practice, that policy shift would mean tribes that operate sports betting facilities would remain at 10%, while operators affiliated with professional sports teams would pay the higher fee, according to October data from the State Department of Gaming and the Governor's Office. The change would generate an estimated $145 million in a year and make Arizona more comparable to other states like New York and Oregon, which charge fees of up to 51%, according to Hobbs' office and her budget. But the Sports Betting Alliance, which represents major betting platforms, FanDuel, BetMGM, Bet365, Fanatics, and DraftKings, said the higher fee would be passed on. When a state raises taxes on sports betting, it's the fans who feel it, Alliance President Joe Maloney said in a statement. Higher taxes means cutting promotions, reducing payouts, and raising fees for everyday fans. This kind of huge tax hike also makes it harder for regulated companies to compete and will push more Arizonans toward illegal betting sites that pay no taxes and offer no consumer protections. Tax battle brewing? Still. Hobbs and GOP lawmakers who control the legislature have proposed different ways to respond to federal tax changes enacted in Trump's package last year known as the Big Beautiful Bill, or H.R. 1. Republicans want a plan that more closely mimics Trump's, but also adds items like increasing a child tax credit and codifying a federal funding program that supports private schools. The Republican majority passed identical bills on January 15th to do just that, which met Hobbs' veto a day later. Hobbs wants a narrow approach and to sort the rest out, particularly provisions that benefit corporations and high-income earners in the budget process. We want a senior working part-time as a Walmart greeter to get a tax cut, Hobbs said. We want a waitress working hard to put food on the table to get a tax cut. The middle class must be our priority. Tax preparers and consumer advocates have encouraged an early resolution to the disagreement for taxpayers' sake, but that remains weeks or months out. The impasse has led to confusion about whether Arizonans should file their taxes or wait. One leading state senator warned Arizonans must not file their state taxes. In cautioning taxpayers, Senator J.D. Mansard, a Chandler Republican who chairs the Senate Finance Committee, was one of the several GOP leaders who blamed the Democratic governor for creating chaos with her own tax-matching plan. Right now, there is uncertainty with the taxpayer, Mansard said. Many Arizonans don't want to wait for their refund. They want to file now. They've got bills to pay. But Hobbs' aides said the majority of taxpayers won't need to refile even if it takes time to reach an agreement. Yet, officials from the State Department of Revenue told lawmakers that any retroactive changes to the policy in H.R. 1 would bring the agency's operations to a halt. They said it would require a $20 million infusion and 200 more staffers to deal with all the amended tax returns. Lawmakers disputed those figures. Republicans ripped Hobbs' plan on a veto, sending the message that she was responsible for any tax filing headaches to come. Hobbs, who was first elected in 2022, is seeking re-election this year in what is widely expected to be a close race. Arizonans are left with mixed signals from the executive branch. Uncertainty for taxpayers and confusion for employers and tax preparers, all created by this veto, House Speaker Steve Montenegro, Republican of Junior, said, of Goodyear, said in a statement. Democrats oppose tax cuts for wealthy people, businesses. Hobbs' package included the federal plan's higher standard income deduction an increased deduction for people 65 and older, and a deduction for interest on new loans on loans for new vehicles assembled in the United States. It eliminated taxes for overtime pay and tips. On January 16th, she used her bully pulpit to call for lawmakers to support the plan, which is being introduced by Democratic leaders Representative Oscar De Los Santos and Senator Priya Sundaresan. The GOP plan, which passed in record time with no negotiation with Hobbs' office, included the same standard deduction and no tax on overtime and tips. It replaced Hobbs' plan for seniors with deductions for pensions and retirement investment account transfers and skips the vehicle loan provision for child care deductions and an increase in per-child tax credits. The most expensive difference is the write-off for expenses and deductions for businesses, which average about $112 million over 3 years. But Republicans said the savings to businesses stay essentially the same as before H.R. 1, except they allow businesses to claim the deductions in the same year they took on the expenses instead of spreading out the savings over several years. Both plans did not match a federal, state, and local taxes deduction, which allows taxpayers to deduct more of their property taxes and sales taxes they paid for their vehicles and other purchases. The difference between the GOP and Hobbs' roughly $700 million in tax cuts, Hobbs and GOP plans average to about $150 million per year over 3 years, according to reports by the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. Lawmakers and Hobbs must approve a state budget later this year that will spend more than $17 billion. Small business owners await clarity on tax refunds. Republicans introduced two small business owners at their January 15th news conference to highlight how their tax breaks don't just benefit multi-million dollar corporations. Jonathan Stewart, owner of Stewart Custom Cabinetry, said his business needs to know what tax returns will look like before they can plan ahead. "I want to employ more people," Stewart said. His company currently employs 9 people. Jeff Fleetham, a one-man operation working construction consulting, said delaying a tax conformity decision will put pressure on small businesses that don't have the staffing to navigate the changing tax code. "We've added this additional burden on these companies that don't have the resources to hire tax experts," Fleetham said. The next article is by environmental reporter Joan Miners and is titled, "Trump is set to repeal landmark regulations on air pollution." The Trump administration appears poised to announce its final repeal of a key ruling that has allowed the federal government to regulate air pollution, watchdog groups and experts say. The administration submitted its final rule on January 7th, seeking to overturn a 2009 decision known as the Greenhouse Gas Endangerment Finding. That finding established the regulatory authority for setting limits on emissions from power plants and vehicles that have been widely and conclusively linked to cardiovascular health, respiratory ailments, and climate change. Its erasure is likely to be immediately met with legal challenges, though Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays declined to comment to the Arizona Republic about her plans. The endangerment finding became part of the Clean Air Act during the Obama administration after the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency determined, based on a large body of scientific research, evidence, and consensus, that the unchecked releases of carbon dioxide, CO2, methane, CH4, nitrous oxide, N2O, hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, perfluorocarbons, PFCs, and sulfur hexafluoride, SF6, compromise the mission of the agency to safeguard human and environmental well-being. In addition to being health hazards and respiratory irritants, these emitted compounds also act as greenhouse gases, trapping heat energy from the sun and resulting in a warming and chaotic atmosphere that has destabilized water flows, crop production, and other natural systems on which humans depend. As of January 15th, the EPA website still stated its determination that these air pollutants threaten the public health and welfare of current and future generations, and that this conclusion served as the prerequisite for implementing greenhouse gas emission standards for vehicles and other sectors. The Trump administration has removed similar statements and documents from the federal websites without warning since taking office. The 2009 ruling triggered the development of improved pollution filters, vehicle efficiency advances, and technologies related to hybrid and electric cars that have saved drivers on unnecessary gas purchases while helping to maintain cleaner air. The Phoenix area in particular has struggled for decades to manage heavy air pollution from vehicle traffic to meet air quality standards. A 2025 analysis by the American Lung Association ranked Arizona fourth in the United States on a number of unhealthy ozone days and 20th in unhealthy annual levels of particle pollution. Both of these pollutants are tied to car emissions. It found that 84% of Arizonans live in communities with unhealthy air. An Arizona Republic reader wrote in last year with concerns about how she can protect her children from the higher asthma risks, lower IQ scores, and lifelong health complications associated with air pollution in Maricopa County. Are we being real with ourselves about the influence of pollution on child obesity rates, asthma, etc., she asked. Medical experts like Tucson-based emergency physician Brian Drummond suggest that we are not. We know that running a gasoline engine car in a garage would be deadly, yet we do the same thing with our atmosphere being a bigger garage. But the toxic fumes aren't escaping, Drummond told the Republic this week in response to these imminent rollbacks on air pollution regulations. Cutting plants to limit fossil fuel pollution by the EPA is key to improving our health and safety. We all breathe the same air, so air pollution is an equal opportunity threat to our health. That equal opportunity threat was largely neutralized by the implementation of the Clean Air Act in 1990. Despite rapid population and economic growth, the United States has seen a steady drop in average concentrations of major air pollutants ever since. Now, Trump's repeal of the 2009 endangerment finding, first announced in late July, threatens that progress. It will undo virtually all of the EPA's actions aimed at regulating greenhouse gases, experts say, risking the health and economic well-being of Americans coast to coast. There's not a whole lot of logic in what they're trying to do. In August, when the Republic first wrote about Trump's attempts to undo these air pollution regulations, Arizona experts weighed in on how the consequences of going backward on efforts to control greenhouse gases in the atmosphere would result in worse wildfires, drought, heat extremes that have been tied to deaths and worker productivity, as well as many other issues that have become central to the state. At the time, the devastating fires at the north rim of the Grand Canyon were still burning. In the same breath, experts warned that this political move represented a broader attack on science-based democratic society. Many scientists took to social media to decry how subversive the Trump administration's protocol for dismantling what had been a rigorous process rooted in scientific debate leading to the 2009 endangerment finding. Instead of weighing the evidence from the full scientific community as the standard, the current repeal relies on a report authored by five scientists with extreme viewpoints. Their document contradicts decades of consensus about climate pollution risks, formerly published by hundreds of scientist authors in the United Nations National Climate Assessments and the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. Trump has now withdrawn the United States from these collaborative research efforts and has paused progress on congressionally mandated climate assessments. The people who think that climate change is not a big deal, they get to speak. They're part of these assessments. Their papers are included because that's the way science works, Diane Pecky, who leads the science team at the National Wildlife Federation and is on leave from her post as a climate science professor at Arizona State University, told the Republic in August. People understand that science is a social process and it shouldn't be based on the opinions of one person. When the Republic caught up with Pecky ahead of the expected announcement that the repeal is now final, she emphasized that science is supposed to be a careful and deliberative process, not just to make sure such decisions are based on both rational argument and empirical understanding, but because flip-flops in policy can be disruptive to industry and a sense of stability across society. The review is supposed to take somewhere between weeks to months, she wrote this week. This particular decision is expected relatively quickly. If, when the rule is overturned, it will be immediately challenged in court. That's not a very good outcome for industry because it will make it difficult for companies to comply with a patchwork of rules. During summer 2025, as the Trump administration pursued and eventually passed this One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the Republic contacted 35 clean energy companies in Arizona that had benefited from industry-friendly policies initiated under former President Joe Biden to ask how they planned to navigate Trump's abrupt erasure of many of those business incentives. Most declined requests for comment, but a few clean energy industry insiders shared anonymously that they were increasingly uncertain about their path to successfully manufacturing solar panels, electric vehicles, and more, but that they feared retribution if they spoke out. At least six companies that had collectively bought billions in investments and thousands of jobs to the state have scaled back or closed their doors. Reduced pollution regulation tends to favor oil and gas expansion projects over the development of cleaner energy technologies. While short-term profits may benefit individuals in the system, analyses have shown that society pays the difference in increased costs to maintain public health and a livable environment. Under Trump, who was investigated in 2024 for accepting a billion-dollar campaign contribution from oil companies in exchange for promises to pave the way for more drilling, the EPA will now stop tracking data on lives saved by limiting air pollution. With vast sun and critical minerals but minimal oil and gas, Arizona stands to lose big on shifts away from investments in renewable energy and back toward fossil fuels. Science is clear that the stability of the climate and human health will also suffer. There is not a whole lot of logic in what the Trump EPA is proposing to do, Patke said. They've made many different and not very cohesive arguments to try and justify this, most of which were already settled during the original ruling. Right now, there doesn't seem to be much enforcement of the basic rules that protect us from air pollution of all kinds, she said. This is very damaging to Arizona in multiple ways, especially in the Phoenix Valley. It's not just climate change alone. The Clean Air Act wasn't perfect, and we still have pollution problems in the valley under the old rules. What will happen when there are barely any rules or enforcement at all? Unfortunately, the Clean Air Act has been in place for so long, people don't remember what cities were like before. What can still be done to protect clean air? When Trump officials announced they've repealed the 2009 endangerment finding, which experts expect to take place with political flair at one of several public events planned for the next few days, it won't immediately change much, especially if the administration was already not enforcing air pollution rules. That means there is hope that residents who object to weakening Clean Air Act can still register resistance by contacting the representatives and senators, Patke suggested. Phone numbers and email addresses for members of Congress can be found at www.congress.gov/contact-us. Members of the public are also able to request a meeting with the U.S. Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs to lodge opposition to RIN 2060-AW71, reconsideration of 2009 endangerment finding and greenhouse gas vehicle standards at www.reginfo.gov/public/do/eo/neweeting? In the 2 months after the Trump administration issued its initial proposal to dissolve this regulatory mandate, the docket received 571,900 comments from the public responding to the change. Multiple analyses, including one by EOS, the public communications magazine of the American Geophysical Union, concluded that the vast majority of them were against reducing limits on air pollution. An analysis by the Inside Climate News of the public testimony held on August 19, 2025, found that fewer than 10 out of 200 people supported the move. Pittsburgh's own Hazel Chandler, a lifelong climate activist and air quality advocate, was among those who spoke out against it, despite being in hospice with cancer at the time. A number of businesses also voiced concerns, according to the Environmental Defense Fund, which plans to file legal challenges as soon as the announcement is made. Among them were automakers like Ford and Honda, as well as the Edison Electric Institute, the trade association representing investor-owned utilities. Many businesses have tracked global shifts toward electric cars and cleaner energy, and don't support going back to more polluting systems. The endangerment finding is supported by a mountain of scientific evidence and has been repeatedly affirmed by the Supreme Court, said Peter Zazzal, counsel and associate vice president for clean air strategies with EDF, in a statement from the environmental group. Hundreds of thousands of Americans, along with business representatives, state and local officials, public health and medical associations, oppose overturning these vital protections. Regardless of what happens next, all this testimony, opposition effort, and evidence of Americans participating in the democratic process will enter into the record of this decision in history. A few months before she died, Aisler Chandler reflected on a lifetime of fighting for slow progress and clean air around Phoenix, sharing that the oscillation of wins and losses can be frustrating, but that she did see meaningful change in her decades as an activist. We have to stand up. We have to get in line. We have to talk to everyone we know, and we have to insist that we take our own steps to help, she told the Republic. I started working on this 60 years ago, and I will be working on it until my last breath, whenever that is. Joan Miners is the climate news and storytelling reporter at the Arizona Republic and AZCentral.com. Her award-winning work has also appeared in Discover Magazine, National Geographic, ProPublica, and The Washington Post Magazine. Before becoming a journalist, she completed a doctorate in ecology. Follow Joan on Twitter at BEECYCLES, on Blue Sky at joan.miners, bluesky.social, or email her at joan.meiners@arizonarepublic.com. Sign up for AZ Climate, the Republic's weekly news, climate, and environment newsletter. Read more of the team's coverage at environment.azcentral.com. You can listen to Sun Sounds either live or on demand by going to our website. Go to sunsounds.org. Click the link labeled Broadcast, Info, and Audio. Then you'll see a box on the left side of the page labeled Programming Links with a link to listen live or for on-demand podcasts. Fittingly, we wrap today's front page with an article titled Community Members Recognized with MLK Jr. Service Awards by Perry Vandal. Community members, young and old, were honored at the Arizona Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast for their civic engagement and service to their community. The event at the Phoenix Convention Center marked the 40th anniversary of an MLK celebration in Phoenix, and Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs and Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego addressed the crowd gathered January 16th. Honorees ranged from an 11-year-old to a longtime Phoenix leader with more than 40 years of service to the community. Speakers urged service and community involvement as the best way to honor King, the civil rights leader committed to nonviolent protest, who was slain in 1968. Cody Williams, a former Justice of the Peace and Phoenix City Council member, received the Calvin C. Good Lifetime Achievement Award for his 4 decades of public service and other passions such as building homes with Habitat for Humanity, coaching youth sports, and mentoring students. The organization awarded 4 community members its Living the Dream Award, which recognizes those who embody the ideas of Dr. King through their continued personal commitment to human relations and social justice. The winners include Martha Northey, an 11-year-old who has spent hundreds of hours volunteering for organizations like Trevor's Vision, which provides meals and clothing to the unhoused. She's organized drives for toys and clothing essentials and led neighborhood cleanups. Sasha Riveron, a leader in multiple organizations including the Governor's Youth Council and the Greater Phoenix Urban League Youth Council. She is president of the NAACP East Valley Youth and is focused on youth access to educational resources and opportunities, such as internships with local policymakers. Rose Honey is a mentor for young women through the International Order of the Rainbow for Girls, a Masonic youth organization. She has organized hydration drives for the unhoused, made birthday cake kits for food pantries, and teacher support efforts for underfunded schools. Courtney Hemphill, a board member of the Desert Financial Foundation who mentors first-generation college students, serves with the American Cancer Society, Action Network, and the American Heart Association and Advocates for Expanded Care in Underserved Communities. The organization also recognized the volunteer youth organization of 100 Black Men of Phoenix, along with the Arizona State Chapter of the National Organization of Minority Architects. Past award winners can be found on the organization's website. This is Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, January 19th, 2026. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. You can listen to Sun Sounds on our mobile app available for both Android and iPhone. You can also listen on your smart speaker by simply saying Alexa, play Sun Sounds, or Google, play Sun Sounds to start the stream instantly. The lead article on the Valley and State page is titled, Liberty Coach Back Despite Ongoing Probe, Brenton Reinstated Amid Sexual Hazing Claims, by Hannah Dreyfus. The Peoria Unified School District has reinstated Liberty High School's lead wrestling coach in his positions as coach and teacher despite an ongoing criminal investigation into his role in permitting sexual hazing on the wrestling team. In a 3-2 vote, the board chose to reinstate coach Eric Brenton to his positions as of January 16th. In addition to the police investigation, the school's internal investigation into the matter is still underway. The board took this action against the advice of their own attorney, who spoke at the meeting shortly before the vote. There are several notices of claim that have been made, and I think it behooves the district, in its fiduciary status, to finish an investigation, Susan Seagal, the governing board's attorney, said. Peoria Police Department spokesperson Christopher Barbros confirmed the criminal investigation was open and active. Governing Board President Heather Rooks led the motion to reinstate Brenton. It was affirmed by board members Janelle Bowles and Becky Proudfit. Rooks preceded her motion and vote by asking Seagal if any Arizona law requires a school employee to remain on leave while under investigation. When Seagal said there is not, Rooks immediately motioned to reinstate Brenton. Before her vote, Proudfit said she is grateful we're not up here tonight being asked to rule on an investigation. This is something that has woken me up in the middle of the night many, many times, said Proudfit. The question that really sticks to my heart is potentially how have we handled one of our own. Board members Jeff Toby and Melissa Ewing voted against the reinstatement. My job is to protect students, the district, and the integrity of the process. I do not prejudge. I do not posture. I don't inflame and I don't interfere, Ewing said, explaining her vote. The best way to protect an employee is to complete the investigation, Toby said, before voting not to reinstate Brenton. In a January 16th email sent to Liberty Wrestling Families, District Superintendent Casey Summers confirmed the board's vote. We know that you will provide him with a warm welcome as he returns to his teaching and coaching positions on the Liberty campus, he wrote. He added that the school's internal investigation is nearing completion. Brenton did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Board's move, highly unusual for school district. Brenton was placed on paid administrative leave in August after an Arizona Republic investigation indicated he had failed to address repeated incidents of sexual hazing on his team. Laura Dunn, a nationally recognized attorney and victims' rights advocate, said this is the first time in her career she has heard of a school board reinstating an employee still under criminal investigation. The move is highly unusual and shows the depth of the school board's poor judgment, Dunn said. The move, she said, is clearly an attempt put a finger on the scale in favor of the employee and could have far-reaching legal ramifications. People in the community who are concerned about this deeply poor judgment that elevates abuse at the expense of those victimized need to run for school board themselves, she said. Robert Pastor, an attorney representing several former wrestlers who alleged Brenton knew they were being sexually hazed but did nothing to interfere, said, the attorney for the Peoria Unified School District made clear that the investigation is not complete. The school board's decision to reinstate Coach Brenton, who had a legal duty to protect children and report abuse, trivializes the rule of a law and endorses a culture that allows these horrific acts to occur. Our kids deserve better. Kevin Bizanian, an attorney for several more former wrestlers with similar allegations against Brenton, said, "This is yet another example of why our legal system must step in to enforce the expectations and standards of our communities." When asked for comment, Peoria District spokesperson Danielle Airy referred to the superintendent's letter to the wrestling community. The Arizona Republic's investigation documented allegations from former wrestlers describing a culture of sexualized hazing inside Liberty's wrestling program, including accounts of students being restrained and assaulted by teammates. Records from Liberty's internal investigation show students told school officials the coach was present in the room during the alleged assaults. Multiple former wrestlers said Brenton was aware of the behavior, but dismissed it as a rite of passage. When school officials failed to act, parents reported concerns to police. In an extensive 196-page police report, investigators described details of video evidence added to the case file in October. The videos include graphic assaults, according to the descriptions in the police report. In one description of an incident recording during an out-of-town trip, police describe a student pulling off another student's pants, leaving him naked from the waist down as he tries to cover himself. The report says other students pushed him back into bed, and the student is heard saying, "That was sexual assault." The featured photo on today's Valley and State page is of some kids playing basketball outside. The caption reads, "Michael Dines jumps to shoot the ball while he plays basketball with Dylan Sands left and Braden Anderson in surprise on January 15th. We turn to another legal news story, this one titled, "Former Scottsdale Prosecutor's Defamation Verdict Gets Tossed" by Taylor Seeley. The Arizona Court of Appeals reversed a lower court's defamation verdict and $3.85 million award for damages to a former Scottsdale prosecutor who sued the city. The reversal is a win for the city, but it's also a victory for news media outlets in Arizona. A coalition of news organizations, including the Arizona Republic, told the judge the verdict and damages could threaten the public's right to access information about their government. Sean Fuller was fired from his job as a Scottsdale prosecutor in 2020. City officials pointed to a report they commissioned that said he discriminated against female employees and behaved unprofessionally. Fuller denied the allegations and claimed he was fired for exposing the city's failure to disclose lab results that were favorable to defendants in some DUI cases. He sued the city for defamation and wrongful termination. A jury sided with Fuller after a 16-day trial, awarding him $5.2 million in what his attorney called a complete vindication. The city appealed the ruling, claiming Fuller didn't present enough evidence to prove wrongful termination and didn't meet the criteria for proving defamation. The Arizona Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's wrongful termination verdict, but agreed that Fuller failed to specify what statements in the city commission report were allegedly defamatory. As a result, the court couldn't conduct the proper analysis to determine whether the statements legally qualified as defamation, Judge D. Stephen Williams wrote. Also, Fuller's actions and inactions deprived the defendants, Scottsdale, of any reasonable opportunity to defend themselves against Fuller's stealthily amorphous trial on the defamation claim, the opinion says. The opinion doesn't set any precedent for future cases, but attorneys can cite it as persuasive authority if there aren't other court opinions that adequately address the subject. That means future wrongful termination or defamation cases won't need to abide by the appellate judge's decision, but their decision could be influential nonetheless. Fuller's attorney, Joshua Cardin, did not immediately respond to a request for comment, and Scottsdale spokesperson Holly Peralta declined to comment. Why Arizona news media opposed the Scottsdale defamation verdict? The dynamic between news outlets and city officials can often be adversarial, but Fuller's case created an unusual alliance between the two as both sought to reverse the defamation claim. For Scottsdale, the stakes were a $3.85 million payout. Media outlets believed the verdict would jeopardize their ability to report the news. Fuller's defamation claim was based off the city report that media outlets widely reported. Media outlets were able to obtain the report through Arizona's public records law, which provides access to most government documents. But if cities believed releasing documents could open them up to legal liability, perhaps they wouldn't provide them, the media outlets' argument went. That would harm the public's right to access information about their government. The risk of seven-figure defamation liability for releasing public records is enough to make even the most diligent public official hesitate to perform this statutory legal duty and can encourage suppression of public records by those with reason to hide that public information, attorney Matthew Kelly wrote. Fuller's attorney said by the media outlet's logic, any large defamation verdict against the government entity must always be overturned as illegitimate if there is any chance it will be harder for news organizations to get public records. Carton told the court if media outlets fear cities will become more reluctant to furnish public records, their response should be to sue the cities for violating the law, not fight verdicts. The actual choice presented to this court is whether public officials should continue to be held accountable for defaming whistleblowing employees without being allowed to pick and choose when they comply with public records law, he wrote. The appellate court decision did not weigh in on the media outlets' arguments. Taylor Seeley is a First Amendment Reporting Fellow at the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Do you have a story about the government infringing your First Amendment rights? Reach her at tseely@arizonarepublic.com or by phone at 480-476-6116. Seeley's role is funded through a collaboration between the Freedom Forum and Journalism Funding Partners. Funders do not provide editorial input. We stay in the courtroom with an article titled Uber Rape Case Reveals More Than 550,000 Sexual Incidents by Miguel Torres. A landmark lawsuit against Uber began trial this month in Phoenix Federal Court in a growing wave of sexual assault claims against the rideshare giant. Jalen Dean thought she was doing the safe thing. After a night out in Tempe in November 2023, she ordered an Uber for a ride home. Dean alleges her driver raped her during the trip. Her lawsuit against Uber, now unfolding in a Phoenix courtroom, is part of several other sexual assault claims against the company. In court, Dean's lawyers argue that Uber's corporate culture encouraged trust in drivers while failing to implement meaningful protections. Uber's attorneys contend the company is not liable for the acts of a third party. In an emailed statement, Uber spokesperson Gabriela Concardo Quesa said, "Sexual assault is a devastating crime, and we take every report extremely seriously. Safety is foundational at Uber, and our commitment to help protect people on the platform will never stop. We continue to invest in innovative technologies, strong policies, and trusted partnerships to strengthen in-app safeguards, help prevent harm, and work with law enforcement and advocates to support survivors." This is the first trial in a federal process that groups similar lawsuits known as multi-district litigation. The outcome could influence how other pending cases against Uber are resolved. The trial began January 13th and is expected to run through the end of the month. Over 550,000 reports of sexual violence from Uber riders. Court filings show that Uber has had complaints from thousands of riders who alleged sexual abuse by drivers. In federal court, more than 90 cases were centralized in the Northern District of California as part of the multi-district litigation. The Dean case was selected as the first test trial. Simultaneously, Uber has defended a parallel group of cases in California state court through a special California state process that lets judges handle similar lawsuits together. Plaintiffs introduced Uber's own data showing over 558,000 reports of sexual violence linked to the platform between 2017 and 2024, according to court records. Plaintiffs said the volume of incidents and the patterns and timing, late nights, weekends, near bars, demonstrate the company's awareness of risk. But the lawsuit claims Uber failed to act decisively even after receiving complaints about the same drivers in prior incidents. Marketing behind Uber's safety strategy. At the heart of the trial is a debate whether Uber prioritized safety sentiment over real safeguards. Plaintiff's attorneys say the company cared more about appearances than action. One internal email from Uber's communications chief, Jill Helsenbecker, showed strategy behind a planned safety report in which she wrote their goal would be to shut down the press cycle in 24 to 48 hours. In a recorded deposition, Helsenbecker said she believed transparency mattered. She pointed out that Uber's 2017 to 2018 safety report acknowledged that women faced unique risks, especially when alcohol is involved. But plaintiffs argued those warnings were buried deep in the document, and Uber never directly alerted drivers or riders to the danger. Inside Uber's own reports, the risks were clear, yet there were no targeted warnings, no rider alerts, and no mandatory training, according to plaintiff's attorneys. Plaintiffs argued this showed a failure to act on known risks. Helsenbecker pushed back, insisting safety was a priority, but said that, for a time, decisions about who got to drive were made by teams focused on growing the business, not protecting passengers. Uber's defense, progress, and protections. Uber argues it has dramatically improved safety over the past decade. Court documents show the company promoted safety improvements through deeper background checks, yearly driver screenings, and barring anyone with serious criminal records, including sexual assault, from getting behind the wheel. The company said that more than 185,000 drivers were removed for misconduct. By 2023, Uber had rolled out a set of safety tools meant to reassure passengers. Features like selfie-based ID checks to verify drivers, an in-app button that connects straight to 911, and even the option to stay online with a live ADT safety agent for the length of the trip. ADT is a private security company that partners with Uber to provide real-time monitoring and emergency response. Helsenbecker testified the company invested in our safety products and technology, and that Uber led the industry in safety features. Still, the plaintiff's lawyers argued that these changes came too late for riders like Dean. They alleged Uber ignored red flags about her driver, including a prior sexual assault complaint that Uber retroactively invalidated. As the Phoenix jury hears testimony, the case is being watched as the test of Uber's liability in future sexual assault claims, and the case may influence the company's legal exposure for years to come. We turn to what I suppose we could consider another legal story titled Cinema's Security Guard Had Violent Breakdown Months Ago by Ronald J. Hansen and Perry Vandal. About 7 weeks after Kyrsten Sinema ended her political career, she made a surprise appearance at the Arizona legislature where her career first showed promise. It was only the first surprise involving the former U.S. Senator. Sinema showed up on February 24, 2025, to convince lawmakers to put public money, $5 million of it, into funding clinical trials of the psychedelic drug Ibogaine. The next surprise came weeks later when the public learned that Sinema's employer, the law firm Hogan Lovells, had earlier invested in the drug. The third surprise became clear on January 15th when many Arizonans learned that Matthew Joseph Amel, one of the men who testified in support of the drug, worked as Sinema's securities guard, later joined her Senate staff, and, according to a lawsuit from his estranged wife, was Sinema's lover. Amel, 39, a former Green Beret and veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, has worked for Arizona University in the past year. The school could not provide information about his work status and work record on January 15th. Sinema, 49, gave ASU $3 million from her unspent campaign contributions in January 2025. Amel's background exploded into public scrutiny after his wife's lawsuit in North Carolina against Sinema became publicly known. Amel is described in the lawsuit as a troubled veteran with brain injuries and neurological problems who relied on marijuana and struggled to find work until he joined Sinema's security staff in 2022. When he faced the legislature, Amel described himself as a expletive, mess. There are signs he is still struggling. A history of erratic, concerning behaviors tied to PTSD. Amel faces a pair of felony assault charges in North Carolina stemming from an alleged November 20th attack on a medical worker who told him he could not leave because of an involuntary commitment relating to erratic behavior and threats. Criminal, civil, and family court records filed in Moore County District Court provide details. Amel's wife filed for full custody of their children the day after Amel's arrest. Her request that his mental health had drastically deteriorated, resulting in him being in a manic, paranoid state. Amel had a mental break and uncontrolled anger toward his rental property manager, she said. Amel called the manager 12 times at 6 a.m. and left 4 messages, court records show. Amel then falsely accused the property manager of breaking into his home, with Amel threatening he would shoot him if he came to the rental property and that he should be scared, records show. Amel also sent the property manager pictures of himself holding guns. It led to Amel being involuntarily committed at Moore Regional Hospital, where he was accused of strangling hospital staff. The documents say Amel had a long history of erratic, concerning behaviors because of post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. They add that Amel had a pattern of keeping the couple's youngest child from school at least once a week, not allowing the child to communicate with Heather while under his care, and spending very little time with their two eldest children. A Moore County District Court judge granted full legal and physical custody of the three children to Heather Amel on November 24th. Spoke to lawmakers about the benefits of Ibogaine. Amel's problems in recent months stand in contrast to the message he delivered to the legislature in February 2025. He said he had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis because of brain lesions caused by trauma and suffered constant migraines. He said his health had improved remarkably after one Ibogaine treatment in Mexico nearly 2 years earlier. "The Army kind of got cut short for me because my body fell apart in me. I really didn't have a purpose after that," Amel said. "I am not on any pharmaceuticals at this point other than hormones. I think this is one of the main things that can alleviate dependency on pharmaceuticals, for sure." Next, we have straight-up political news with an article titled "Incumbents, Newcomers Compete for Fort McDowell Council" by Deborah Utitia Kroll. David McLevane handed out donuts underneath a pop-up tent across the street from the Fort McDowell Yavapai Nation's Recreation Center on a chilly January 13th. He told potential voters that he would promote new housing, more support for elders, and new revenue sources. McLevane and 9 other candidates for the 3 seats on the 950-member Tribes Council were making one last push to attract votes on Election Day. Each candidate set up a booth with food, drink, and in some cases comfy chairs as they engaged with voters and their families. Fort McDowell elects half its council every 2 years to ensure continuity in governance. Incumbent council member Albert Cornelius Nelson, who was seeking a second 4-year term, had barbecue, pulled pork, and cupcakes at the ready. Patio chairs surrounded a small fire pit so people could sit in comfort while talking with a candidate or enjoying lunch. Next door, Madonna Warrington, who was running for tribal secretary, had tostadas, Spanish rice, and water on hand. She referred the Arizona Republic to her campaign flyer with her platform, providing a strong, reliable standard of operations and clear, consistent communications with tribal members and tribal staff. And former Fort McDowell President Bernadine Burnett, who hoped to return to tribal leadership after 2 years out of office, served homemade menduo and fry bread. Burnett's nearly unbroken 31-year streak in the council ended in 2024 when Sandra Patea, daughter of longtime Fort McDowell President Clinton Patea, narrowly defeated Burnett for the presidency. Burnett narrowly defeated Albert Cornelius Nelson for the at-large seat, while Vice President Paul Russell and fellow incumbent Verlene Baptisto retained their seats on the council. All 3 winners are either incumbents or former council members. The tribal tradition of serving food during Election Day serves a more serious purpose. if gives candidates one more chance to win votes and learn what constituents expect of them should they win the election or re-election. And in a small community like Fort McDowell, knowing what's on their members' minds is important for effective governance. Housing, economic development, constitutional changes on voters' and candidates' minds. Most of the 10 candidates said they would focus on economic development, housing, and keeping a close eye on expenditures. No new businesses have opened in the 24,000-acre reservation in several years, although the tribe's tourism enterprises, rebranded under the We Copa name when the new casino opened in 2020, just in time for the COVID-19 pandemic. Rhonda Pilcher, who was running for vice president, said she felt the tribe had been stagnant too long and would promote economic growth and self-sufficiency. She also said she would push for a code of ethics for the tribal council. "I believe our leaders must uphold transparency and integrity, just as they expect from us," Pilcher said. Pansy Thomas, who has formerly served as vice president, tribal secretary, treasurer, and council member, also pledged to streamline tribal operations, defend the tribe's water rights, and improve revenues. Burnett said she would like to expand the tribe's Wasaya Mental Health Center to accept more patients, including non-native patients, which would require moving the clinic to a new location. She also said the tribe needs to improve its infrastructure and continue growing its economy, provide jobs, and educate its children to become the next generation of tribal managers. Another issue on both voters' and candidates' minds, revising enrollment criteria. Fort McDowell's current constitution, adopted in 1999, requires a potential member have at least one quarter of Fort McDowell Yavapai blood. However, with less than 1,000 members, that has become very difficult as tribal members seek to avoid marrying close relatives, find spouses outside the community. Incumbent Vice President Paul Russell said the path for the tribe to move forward must include an open door for our children and grandchildren to become members. More than 370 eligible voters weighed in with their choices. Their ballots were counted that evening at the Recreation Center in full view of any tribal member who wished to observe. Tiny tribe, big footprint. Fort McDowell has been at the forefront of many pivotal events in Indian country. Their most famous member, Wasaya, also known as Carlos Montezuma, spearheaded a push to preserve the tribe's lands and advocated for tribal rights in the early 20th century. In 1948, after an early attempt by Gila River members failed, Yavapai tribal members Frank Harrison and Harry Austin successfully sued to affirm the native people's right to vote. In the 1970s and early 1980s, the small tribe also stood firm against a proposed dam that would drown most of its tribal lands and now commemorate that struggle each November at Orne Dam Victory Days. That's all we have time for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, January 19th, 2026. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to Hour 1 and encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2 on our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.